This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. According to some reports, the negotiations to complete a draft constitution for Iraq drew more divisive as yesterday's deadline approached, and some delegates said that as the clock ticked toward midnight, they were further apart than ever. Other reports are more optimistic. U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad told reporters today that he was disappointed by the failure to reach agreement, but that many difficult issues have been resolved: the role of Islam, the rights of women, the structure of the government, and he described areas of disagreement largely as matters of detail. While the ambassador said he expects disputes can and will be ironed out before next week's new deadline, the unsettled areas include issues of vital importance, the division of Iraq's vast oil wealth, and the related issue of the central government's relationship to Iraq's provinces and its regions. Today we'll focus on that issue, usually referred to in shorthand as either federalism or autonomy. Later in the program, the crash of an airliner in Greece prompts new questions about those oxygen masks above every airline seat, and we'll hear the story behind the state of Georgia's decision to pardon a woman convicted of murder 60 years after she was executed. But first, federalism in Iraq, what it is, who wants it, who doesn't, and why. If you have questions about the history behind the divisions in Iraq, the importance of unity, and the risks of conflict within and among Iraq's various factions, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from Baghdad is Ellen Nickmeyer, Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. It's very good to have you on the program.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be with you.
What has been the reaction there in Baghdad today to the failure last night to reach agreement by the deadline?
Today, all the politicians involved, all the diplomats involved, are very busily publicly putting a good face on what happened, saying that it was a disappointment, but it wasn't a major failure or collapse of the talks, and that they're confident things will be solved in the extra week that the negotiators have given themselves.
Nevertheless, we have heard reports that the divisions erupted even more sharply during yesterday's last-minute negotiations.
That's right. In the last few days of the talks, you saw more splits emerge. One of the Shia parties came out very strongly for a strong southern Shia federal state, and the other Shia party said this can't happen, and that was a very public rift between even the Shia parties, and the Shia and the Kurds are disagreeing on federalism and the role of Islam in the constitution, and just a lot of issues and a lot of rifts have emerged that weren't as evident before.
And at this point, when are they planning to resume negotiations?
There's conflicting accounts of that. Some delegates say that they've already started talking again, that they were back into talks informally this morning. I think the talks are formally supposed to resume later.
And again, I guess we can assume that it's going to be deadline pressure again a week later.
That's right, yeah. Politicians here, like politicians most places in the world, go down to the wire, and lots of the hard deals don't get made until 11, and the 11th hour, literally. So that's not anything special here, that it would take a deadline, and the last hour is the deadline to make a deal.
As you know, I'm sure, the politicians here in Washington, the Bush administration, says a failure to reach a draft constitution and go ahead with the elections as scheduled, this would send a terrible message to the insurgents in Iraq. What do people in Baghdad say about it? Are they concerned about this deadline?
Day to day, when we talk to people out in the streets, they're still more concerned about the fact that their electricity is not on and that they have to stand in line for several hours to get gasoline. Kind of the hardships of life in Baghdad are still the consuming thing. And I don't think that people are hanging on for every development on the Constitution. And there's still a surprising amount of optimism out on the streets, too, that And some people believe that, you know, when it comes down to it, the leaders will come out with an agreement. And some people say no, and it'll go to civil war. There's a real range of ideas here.
That last idea, again, you're saying some people are saying the inevitable result is civil war.
Well, that's something you hear all the time, and just from the street, we talked to someone yesterday who just talked about how much distrust there is on all sides and how much fear there is on all sides. And it was a money changer. We talked to him in Baghdad, and he very succinctly said, you know, these people have to put aside the trust that they've distrust that they've grown up with, they've spent all their lives with, and that's difficult to do.
Ellen Nickmeyer, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this evening.
You're welcome.
Ellen Nickmeyer, Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. She joined us from Baghdad. Iraq's Kurds have long led calls for autonomy, with a continued push to gain control of a region around the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Kubad Talabani is the U.S. representative of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and the Iraqi Kurdistan Regional Government. He's also the son of Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani. He joins us now by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C., and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Why is autonomy of federal Iraq so important to Iraq's Kurds?
When Iraq's Kurds look at their lives over the last 12 years, they've seen themselves to be almost independent. They've been administering their own affairs, building civil institutions, institutions of government, building civil society. And now we have a new Iraq, a new vision for the country, and geopolitics and the will of the Kurdish political leadership dictates that Iraq remains as one piece. So in order for this to be a voluntary union, a federation where power is decentralized from the central government, given to the federal regions, creating checks and balances is the only viable and acceptable solution to the Kurds of Iraq.
I was reading what Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad said to reporters today in Baghdad. One of the things he was talking about in terms of federalism and the Kurds was federalism is now a way to bring the Kurds back into Iraq, a state that they have largely been disconnected with since 1991.
Absolutely, and this has been our argument all along. People collate federation to separation. And we actually say that federation is integrating a separate entity, as it is today, into Iraq.
Our number, by the way, if listeners would like to get involved in this conversation about the critical issue of federalism and autonomy in Iraq, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Aaron. Aaron calling from Wilmington, Delaware.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a question. As far as I understand it, as part of the federalism agreement that's being proposed for the Constitution, there's supposed to be a referendum for Kurdistan to opt for independence a few years down the road. And if I was a Shia or a Sunni looking at this Constitution with something like that as part of it, I guess it looked to me a bit like a poison pill, something there that it only kind of staves off the inevitable breakup of Iraq. Do I have the facts right? And is that true, is my question.
Kubad Talabani?
Aaron, the issue of a referendum was brought into the debate during the negotiations. It wasn't something that was ultimately agreed upon or rejected during the talks. But in any civilized democratic society, a people should have the right to self-determination. And a call for a referendum, which has actually been a very strong push by the people of Iraqi Kurdistan, calling on Iraqi and Kurdish political leaders to give the people of Kurdistan a voice in how their future should be dictated, is a viable cause. Whether it'll pass in the Constitution, whether it'll actually happen, that is undecided yet. But it comes back to Iraq being a voluntary union with all of its constituencies.
Go ahead, Aaron. I'm sorry.
I guess in my head, you know, what you say that I can't help but think of the American federalism and the struggle that we had with that very same question in the mid-19th century with the Civil War itself. And, I mean, to this day, there's you know, still a certain amount of bitterness about being held together in a union. It seems to me that a decision to allow a referendum like that would mean just, I mean, it would just mean the end of Iraq, but it would just be in 3 years from now as opposed to now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that politically that, I mean?
Let me put the question this way to Mr. Talabani. Is autonomy a precursor to secession?
It is not. Federalism is a precursor for a functioning state in Iraq. Iraq has been ruled as a unitary state since its inception, and in the opinion of many, it has been a failed state since its inception. So the federalism is a way to integrate Iraqi Kurdistan into Iraq, and if it works, great. And if Iraqi Kurds start benefiting from the state of Iraq, then you'll probably hear the nationalistic voices, the Kurdish nationalistic voices, quieten down and actually be happy being part of Iraq. But there always has to be an element left aside to say that if Kurds do not benefit from the state of Iraq, then why should they be condemned to live in an environment that is not conducive to them, that does not support their wishes and their demands, and doesn't supply them with the economic and political development that they deserve.
Aaron, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And before, we just have a few seconds left, Mr. Talabani, but if a federal state is good for Kurds, is it also good for Shias in the southern part of Iraq?
Federalism should be good for all Iraqis, and it will be good for all Iraqis because it'll create checks and balances. It'll create checks and balances that'll prevent the re-emergence of another dictator. And that is, it's an Iraqi project, not a Kurdish project. We need to devolve political and economic power away from the center of Iraq. That way, you're supplying the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds with enough autonomy, with enough administrative rights and political and economic control over their own affairs to keep all the communities of Iraq happy.
Kubad Talabani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kubad Talabani is the U.S. representative of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan and of the Iraqi Kurdistan Regional Government. He is also the son of Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani, and he joined us from his office in Washington. We're talking about the particularly thorny issue of federalism or autonomy in Iraq, one of the things that's still hanging up the draft constitution. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK or email us, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Leaders of Iraq's Kurdish population have long expressed a desire for autonomy in northern Iraq, so it was expected to be a contentious issue in the give and take over Iraq's draft constitution. Then, as negotiators neared the original deadline for the document, a leading politician, a Shiite leader, called for autonomy in Shiite areas of southern and central Iraq. The question of autonomy may be the most difficult barrier on the way to Monday's new deadline for a draft constitution. Would it inevitably lead to separate states, a balkanized Iraq? 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Larry Diamond, who served in 2004 as a senior advisor to Iraq's coalition government. He worked on Iraq's political transition, including drafting an interim constitution. He's the author of Squandered Victory, The American Occupation and the Bungled Effort to Bring Democracy to Iraq. He's with us now from the studios of Stanford University, where he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to be with you, Neil.
And Edmund Garib is also with us. He's a distinguished professor at the School of International Service at American University, co-author of the book Historical Dictionary of Iraq. He's with us from the studios of member station WAMU here in Washington, D.C. And it's nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thank you.
Edmund Garib, going back to the British occupation, the Ottoman Empire, how was Iraq created? There were three different provinces in what is now Iraq.
Yes, as you know, Neil, basically what we saw is that much of the Middle East, not only Iraq, but certainly Iraq, was one of the states which were born after the dismemberment, the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
The Ottoman Empire was defeated by the Allies during the First World War, and as a result, we saw that increasingly many of these states emerged as a result of this dismemberment, and the new states were based. Basically, Iraq was established from three provinces, Mosul, Basra, and Baghdad. And the three states actually came together based on a historical legacy where there has always been, by the way, we never had a state of Iraq up until 1921.
Mm-hmm.
But you always had an Iraq for a very long time. Some historians say it goes back to the Confederation of Sumerian City-States, but certainly there was a reference to Iraq in pre-Islamic Arab poetry and during the early period periods under Islam. But you never had a state, and the three states came together, these three regions, these three provinces, to form modern Iraq. Part of the problem emerged is that the new state was based now on a different kind of identity, different kind of loyalty than the old state. The two old empires, the Ottoman, the Persian, were based on religion. Religious loyalty, religious identity was predominant. Now the new nation states began to base their own identity on majority nationalist identity, and this ultimately led to the creation of problems between the majorities and the minorities, and in this case, for example, between the Arabs and the Kurds, between Turks and Kurds in Turkey, and in other areas. And this ultimately led to this increasing tension. The more the state began to emphasize majority nationalist identity, the more the minorities became chafed under it, and the more they resisted, the more oppression, ultimately leading to a great deal of conflict in the 60s and 70s in Iraq between the Kurds and the Arab-run central government.
And one more question, Edmund Gariba. Do those the borders of those three Turkish provinces or Ottoman provinces, do they accord roughly to what would be today Kurdistan, the proposed Shiite autonomous region, and the central region around Baghdad, where most of the Sunnis live?
Not exactly, but in some areas they are pretty close to it. For example, in northern Iraq, you have the old Mosul province, which the Turks claimed for a longer period after 1921 until 1926, when an agreement was reached under the League of Nations according the Mosul province to Iraq. But the other parts, they changed somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Larry Diamond. And back in the CPA days, the Coalition Provisional Authority, then and now, the U.S. government has pushed very strongly for a unified state, but for a separate federal arrangement for the Kurds. The argument behind that?
Well, first, I would modify what you said, Neil. We pushed for federalism in principle, but we wanted federalism based on the 18 provinces that now exist in Iraq. More like a kind of American federalism where there's not one big ethnic region, but devolution of power to geographic units. The Kurds made a compelling case, and I think that we could not have gotten to where we are now without accepting it, that they had had an autonomous region where they had, since 1991, at the end of the first Gulf War, they had been able to use their own language, preserve their own culture, develop their own democracy and civil society. And if they were going to be able to contain strong nationalist pressures from within Kurdistan for independence, the only way they could do that was to continue at least what they already had, which was autonomy. But the key is that we wanted a federal system based on provinces, still with a strong center for the rest of the country. And I think that's what's at stake now with the new demand on the part of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq for one grand Shiite region spanning the entire south of the country, is whether a more limited provincial-based federalism is going to be preserved, or the country is going to descend into two or three big ethnic regions.
Here's an email question, and I'd like both of you to address it. This from Keith in San Rafael. Why can't we just let the peoples of Iraq break up and go their own ways like India and Pakistan did long ago or after the fall of the Soviet Union? The UN could oversee an equitable oil-sharing arrangement for all concerned. Edmund Gariba, get you first.
I think there are a number of reasons for this. First of all, the United States has said that it wants to maintain the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iraq, which means the unity of Iraq as it was before the war. But that is, of course, an American position. But the question is, what do most Iraqis want? There's no doubt that I think the majority of the Kurds, if they were given a free choice, they would like to have an independent Kurdistan. But Iraq's neighbors with large Kurdish populations, Turkey, Iran, Syria, and others, would not look with favorably upon this. And so therefore, the issue of federalism for the Kurds is, I think, a very legitimate point. And I think that sort of an autonomy was reached even in principle with the previous governments in 1970. As for the rest of the country. The problem, there's a real problem, that is, while the Kurdish region is somewhat homogenous, although there are other minorities within the Kurdish region, but the rest of the country, if you take a place like Baghdad, Baghdad may have about 2 million Shia Arabs, 2.25 million Arab Sunnis, 650,000 Christians, maybe close to 1 million Kurds. How are you going to divide those? I think if we try to divide those people, you will see another Lebanon, another Afghanistan, another Yugoslavia, which would make those areas look like a picnic in comparison if we're going to have ethnic cleansing. In addition, there are some areas in the south where there is mixture. There are a lot of families, Kurds and Arabs, Shia and Sunnis, which have intermarried. So how do you go about dividing that? Mm-hmm. That's why I think this issue of division, of dividing the country, is not a real response.
And Larry Diamond?
Well, I think Professor Gharib has given an excellent answer, quite realistic. There would be international war because Syria, Turkey, and Iran, all of which have Kurdish minorities, would not stand for an independent Kurdish state, much as I think the Kurds, in principle, in a strict, absolute moral sense, should have a right to it, just as you could say, well, maybe Taiwan should have a right to be independent, but you always have to weigh the political consequences of pursuing it. And I do think there would be absolute civil war in the country. I want to add that if you broke up the country, the Shiites would have most of the oil in the far south. The Kurds, if they were, as they're likely to, extend their control over Kirkuk, would have some considerable oil revenue in their regions. And the Sunnis in the center of the country would be left with nothing. This is one reason. It's not the only reason why the Sunni delegates on the Constitutional Conference are adamant about retaining a strong center and having the national state be the sole responsible authority for the oil revenue, because otherwise they will lose out, and they will lose out very badly, and they are panicked at the thought of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a caller on the line. Let's go to Al. Al calling us from Minneapolis.
It's quite a lead-in you had right there, because that is kind of my opinion on the whole thing. Is I think when it comes down to everything on this whole discussion, and a lot of it is going to come down to just following the money on this. I mean, the oil revenues are going to be huge in determining, you know, the way this whole thing plays out. And just as an aside, my personal opinion is I think within a year to two after we are completely out of there, I do believe it's going to unfortunately turn into a Lebanon type of situation. But what do you guys think? What's your opinions?
Well, money is always a powerful consideration, and I think it's part of what's motivating the party that I mentioned, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, or SCIRI, mm-hmm. and its governors, who control most of the nine Shiite majority provinces, to push for this one grand Shiite region. But I think that it's a very important principle of a future viable and stable Iraq that oil revenue be controlled by the center, and then it might be dispensed back in considerable measure to the regions. But that should happen largely on a demographic basis. After all, it's largely an accident of geography that one area has oil and another doesn't, and it's in principle fair and more equitable to have a reasonably fair distribution of this revenue across the country.
Go ahead, Edmund Green.
I think giving control to these regions, and if these regions are based on either ethnicity or sectarianism, I think this is a recipe for future conflicts, because if the Kurds, for example, who have fought for about almost 40 years to gain their rights, their cultural and political rights in Iraq, and kept the Iraqi state destabilized, then they are somewhere between 17% to 19%, maybe 20% of the population, then the Sunnis, who are somewhere between 22 to 25%, can do something similar. So this is a recipe for future conflict, and I agree with Professor Diamond. I think what's needed is that there has to be control by the central government over the resources of the country, and then these resources would be distributed in accordance with the proportion of the population and on the rest of the regions in the country. But I think there has to be a central government control which would accord that all of these different parties would have a share.
But Larry Diamond, how do you write up a constitution that says it's all right for the Kurds to have autonomy or a federal state, but not okay for the Shias?
Well, Iraq would not be the first instance where there is this what we call asymmetrical federalism. Spain has it with the Basques and the Catalans, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other instances, and you do it in part by the recognition of history, reality, so on and so forth. The history is the Kurds have had, as has been noted, some considerable autonomy in recent decades, and they are a much more distinct minority. Whereas the Shiites are a majority. Why does a majority need a separate region? The reason why is not even ethnic, it's political. Juan Cole, I think, had a very interesting analysis of this on his website the other day, whereby this party Skiri, the most Islamist of the Shiite political parties, controls most of the Shiite provinces and is now pushing for this because they would be in control of this region and its revenue flows.
We're talking about autonomy or federalism, as it's sometimes called, in Iraq, a major sticking point as Iraq's constitution writers face a new deadline next week. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Hassan. Hassan calling from North Potomac in Maryland.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm curious that the role of Turkey is not really mentioned very often, and I think, as the other people know, Turkey plays a major role, and Turkey is quite concerned with two factors. Number one, that the Kurds talk about federation and independence, but they seem to be actively suppressing the Turkmen minority amongst them. And the second issue, of course, is that if they do become a federated state, they ultimately will probably lead to independence, which is, in a sense, a threat to Turkey, in a sense that it might encourage, and certainly would encourage, I suspect, Turkey's Kurdish minority to also seek a perhaps union with this new Iraqi state. So I wonder if that role is not being considered very, very seriously.
Larry Diamond, Turkey did not endear itself to the United States before this most recent conflict in Iraq, but there are other issues going back many centuries.
I understand, but let me say to Professor Gharib speak to the history a little bit more, but let me say to Hassan that I think federalism is a way of containing the potential pressure for secession and not fostering it. If you get a good balance in a federal system between the power of the federated units, and in this case the most autonomous of them, Kurdistan, and the power of the center, it can give people a stake in the future political system, in being part of the country, give them autonomy while knitting the country together at the same time. Whereas if you deny this, then I think you accentuate the incentives within this region, which, by the way, I think 90% of Kurdistan would vote for independence today if they could really have a vote, and that's what the last informal referendum suggested in January. So if you don't have this, I think you could have a slide toward independence. I think Turkey will accept a reasonable degree of federalism in Iraq, but obviously not a constitutional provision that would enable the Kurds to secede.
Mm-hmm. Agree, Edmund Gharib?
Yes, I think the Turks have more or less come to an agreement of the de facto autonomy for the Kurds. But the question of an independent Kurdish state is something else. They have looked at it, at least in the past, and the military has warned, as well as some of the political leaders, that this would be a sort of a red line. Because if there are 4 to 5 million Kurds in Iraq, there are somewhere between 16 to 18 million Kurds in Turkey, and the Kurds are very much afraid about the example that that's going to set for their own Kurds, especially since we have seen also a rise, although it's small, relatively speaking, in Kurdish nationalist activity and attacks against Turkish forces within the last few months, within the last year. The second issue is that there is the Turkmen community, which is the third largest community, ethnic community within Iraq. And the Turkmen think of themselves as ethnic Turks. And Turkey has in the past tried to play the role of being the protector for the Turkmen community. And the Turkmen think that Kirkuk belongs to them. And this is what makes Kirkuk has the potential of being a powder keg. This is why I think it's very important what kind of an arrangement is going to be made, because as long as this arrangement, as long as the different parties in Iraq do not see politics as a zero-sum game, then I think there is a chance for agreement for survival of this union. But if each party looks at the whole thing as simply as a zero-sum game and what it can get for itself, then that's a different story. One other point, and
very quickly,
not all the Shia in Iraq, by the way, have supported this idea of a Shiite region. In fact, Prime Minister Jafari, who heads a Dawah party, has opposed it. In the past, Ayatollah Sistani, the leading Shiite cleric, has also opposed it.
It's important to remember differences within as well as among the groups. Hassan, thank you for the call. And our thanks to Larry Diamond, a former senior advisor to Iraq's coalition government, and to Edmund Gharib, a professor at the School of International Service at AU. This is NPR News.